Will history remember Rio as the swan song gathering of the U.S.-led world order as we now know it? The curtain coming down on Joe Biden's last G20 summit, his last big global gathering before the return of Donald Trump to the White House. The outgoing U.S. president, who turns 82 on Wednesday, is slightly older than the United Nations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, all institutions that have evolved on Washington's watch. The neoliberal rules of the global game, often referred to as the Washington Consensus, Washington, which, by the way, hosted the first G20 summit to find common response to the 2008 financial crisis. Now, already there are clubs to rival that consensus, including the BRICS, whose most recent summit was in Russia, and bids to bypass the U.S. dollar as the world's currency. Trump himself is a convert to crypto and vows to ratchet up tariffs. Is it really the end of an era? There's a bit of foreboding by some in Rio. We'll ask about the G20's bid to front-load financing on global poverty, on climate change. Can the rest of the world Trump-proof common rules to rein in the excesses of globalization? The answer, after January the 20th. Today in the France 24 debate, is it goodbye old world order? And with us from Geneva, award-winning Brazilian journalist Jamil Chad. Great to see you.
Bonsoir, great to see you too.
From New Delhi, Siddharth Varadarajan, founding editor of The Wire News Site. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be with you.
Stephen Ekovich is professor emeritus of political science at the American University of Paris. Good evening.
Thank you.
And André Lauzicourt-Pretry, president of the Joint European Disruption Initiative. How are you?
Hello, François.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. The argument's been made before in this very studio about whether most summits are as much about photo ops as final communiques. So here we go. Dateline Rio. This was Monday. And the question is, as we look at the images that are kind of come up now, where is Joe Biden for the family photo? In the end, Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan asked to shuffle to his left to fill the void next to India's Narendra Modi. The U.S. delegation arrives, but too late. So did, by the way, Canada's Justin Trudeau and Italy's Giorgia Meloni. I don't know how much we need to read into the fact that Biden missed the family photo, Stephen Ekovich.
Well, it seems like an appropriate metaphor. In any case, Biden arrives at a G20 that's become a real thick patch of fog, covered by the shadow of Donald Trump. And that leaves a lot of uncertainties for the future, especially since Donald Trump announced during his campaign that he was going to place a 20% tariff on everything, which is a fundamental violation of one of the basic rules of the international liberal order. He wants to withdraw from the Paris Accord also. That's not to say that very many countries have really met their targets or even gotten close to it, but still. But even more than that, he wants to, pump more and more hydrocarbons possibly also even pollute the atmosphere even more. So
yeah.
So here we are. There's a lot of uncertainties. Where are we going from here?
Yeah. A lot of uncertainty and a lot of tension. Yeah. The curtain coming down on this summit in Rio on the day when it's 1,000 days. Since Russia launched its all-out invasion of Ukraine. By the way, that family photo also included a furtive handshake between France's president, Emmanuel Macron, and the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, president of Russia, has skipped G20s since that all-out invasion 1,000 days ago. Summits, do they matter? Let's get that question out of the way.
We talk a lot about the Washington consensus, and the G20 is about the 85% of GDP represented by these countries. 80% of GDP, 85% of emissions. It used to be an economic club. The problem is we are not anymore in an economic world. We are in a geopolitical world, where actually technology and defense and security matter more than economy. We can see very clearly what's happening in China, where economy is now less important than, security, nationalism, etc. So I think the club does not have anymore the operating system, I would say, to deal with what matters today, which is security, technology, and just power And that's why Trump is actually the unifying factor, because everybody's only talking about him because he is bringing in a radically new software to the game.
Yeah, and the elephant in the room, as you say, or as Politico reports it, he who must not be named is the president-elect of the United States. Of course, there are outliers. All too happy to toast the re-election of Donald Trump is Argentina's far-right president, Javier Milei. Siddharth Varadarajan, who's also or at least walked out of the COP climate summit that's taking place in Azerbaijan, and he's a fan of the change that's coming in Washington. A club like the G20 doesn't like uncertainty, or does it, or is it mixed? What's the view where you are?
So is this a question for me?
Yes.
Look, I think India is heavily invested in the G20. And the summit held in New Delhi last year was used to great domestic propaganda effect by Prime Minister Modi. So I think India is very happy to be in the G20, to take part in its events, and is also one of those countries that is quite happy that Donald Trump has won the election. And we can discuss over the show how these contradictions get resolved and what they mean for the world. But from the Indian point of view, from the official Indian point of view,
happy about the re-election of Donald Trump?
Well, I think Modi and Trump got along very well in Trump's first term, and I think Trump's decision, we imagine, to more sharply pivot U.S. strategic policy towards China as the primary enemy, primary adversary, rather than getting focused excessively on Russia, is something which suits India geopolitically, because Russia is a country India has good relations with, and the fact that U.S.-Russia relations are in a very bad place today, it does not help India. And India sees tension between Moscow and Washington as something which drives Russia towards China. So to the extent to which Trump is going to reconfigure, or he says he's going to reconfigure U.S. Foreign policy in that regard, this is something Delhi reckons will make life a little bit easier for itself. And there are other reasons too, but I think this will be the primary one.
So basically, we could talk about it, what happened at the recent BRICS summit. We saw India and China patch up differences. Listening to what Siddharth just said, Andrei Lozukov-Petry, is it the sense that Trump can play the bad cop when it comes to China and the rest of the world can get on with business?
Well, I think we need to wait, but I would not bet on deep strategic thinking, and this is not now a value assessment. I think Trump is going to be Trump, which means super, super transactional. So I think all those who think that they can get an advantage out of it might actually get very disappointed. I don't know for India, but I think a lot of countries will realize that the only policy that Trump will pursue is America first. And so all competitive companies or countries will face Trump as an adversary.
Jamil Shad, it was quite striking to see that reluctant handshake on Monday between the host of the summit, Lula, and Javier Milei, one who's a cheerleader, the other whose predecessor staged or is accused of staging his own equivalent of a January 6th. For Brazil, was it uncomfortable hosting this summit at this particular moment in time?
Well, François, regarding the relationship with Milei, absolutely. First of all, you have to understand the Brazil-Argentinian relationship is absolutely key in South America. It has been the key of foreign policy in Brazil since the 80s. So having a split between the two, or some of the two most important economies in Latin America, obviously it has an impact. Milei, during the summit, he attempted to derail the negotiations in many ways, including in climate change, saying that he would not sign up to any document that mentioned climate change or gender equality. These were the two terms that he refused to sign up to. But at the same time, it was taken as a cautionary tale of what could be a summit with Donald Trump in it. So more than Milei himself or Argentina itself as a country, what Milei in a way showed was, this is the evaluation of especially Brazilian diplomats, say, well, this may be what the G20 will be in 2025 when South Africa will host, but mainly in 2026 when Donald Trump himself would preside over the BRICS.
Hang on, let's follow your reasoning all the way through here, Jamil, because it's true Javier Milei pushed back on almost everything that was in that final communique, but he did bend and sign on, especially when it came to that bit about finding a mechanism to tax the super rich. So maybe Trump will first make a scene and then bend? Is that what we can expect?
Well, obviously the U.S. or Argentina is not the U.S. It has no similar power to what Trump has. It is also true that Milei, despite having signed up to the final document, it reserved basically saying, well, I'm not accepting some of the paragraphs of the final declaration. So in a way, as you said, yes, maybe it was a scene, maybe it was much more of a statement than a decision itself, but still, it raised a question mark on what would be a summit with Donald Trump in it. Now, remember, Milei was someone that over the last couple of months criticized not only the G20 itself, but also the Brazilian government. During the meeting, some people that were inside the closed door meetings were saying how Milei tried to push the agenda of new liberalism, saying that it was in fact new liberalism that brought out millions of people from poverty. And this obviously caused a heated debate during the meeting. Even President Lula later said that the globalization of neoliberalism had failed. So you see, there is obviously a, I would say, a bitter taste of having the summit at this point when the two, let's say, old friends of South America can hardly shake hands at this point.
Stephen Ekovich, which one is it? What's the new world order going to be like? Is it tariffs or is it cowboy capitalism, if you will, a very libertarian view of capitalism the way Javier Milei espouses it?
I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows. But what I can say is that international institutions like the G20, like the World Trade Organization, and like the IMF, like the World Bank, were all created to bring some predictability to markets and to financial transactions. Donald Trump is a very erratic decision maker, and he even may find some pleasure, and maybe in some of his own self-interest, in sort of throwing bombs into those stable institutions. Donald Trump will, will reward those rich friends of his who are loyal. I think your guest who pointed out that Donald Trump is a transactional operator has really hit the nail on the head, because I'm not sure that our colleague from India can really count, as you've pointed out, count on an enduring, faithful relationship between the leaders of India and Donald Trump, because he will do what is best for Donald Trump and not necessarily what's best for America. And that doesn't mean he's going to be – that means he may – if he has to, he will use the leader of India for those purposes. So I wouldn't count too much on the faithfulness of a Donald Trump relationship.
I remember when Donald Trump was elected the first time, 2016, everybody was talking about this famous Gramsci word, you know, the old world is dead, the new world is not yet born, and it's in this between epochs that monsters appear. And I think we are in this time. I mean, all these institutions are institutions which were made for the old world order, and we don't have yet institution for the new world order. So this sense of uncertainty is just maximum. And that's why everybody is also trying to push its own advantages. And we have to be very careful, because it's only those with a very clear vision of what they want to do that will probably prevail in the next coming months and years.
And with others. And with others.
Yeah. Siddharth Varadarajan, John, you agree?
Yeah, I think we are entering enormous uncertainty. And I don't dispute the fact that Trump is going to be highly transactional. What I was presenting was essentially the rather rosy view that the government of India and its advisors tend to take. My own view may be a little bit different from theirs, obviously. But I think that the key global body that's going to undergo all kinds of, you know, issue questions about its relevance is perhaps not the G20 so much as, say, the G7. You know, the G20, I mean, if we think of the global situation today, you have BRICS emerging as a large multilateral forum with Russia, India, China, Brazil, South Africa, lots of other countries there, many countries queuing to join up. And you have, you know, you have traditional Western-led groups like the G7. And the G20, we should think of the G20 as a global, as a round table which allows everybody to come and talk at the same place. So BRICS is represented there, so is the West. And I don't think the G20 is necessarily going to diminish or dissipate. But I think the greatest amount of uncertainty that Trump brings is in his, you know, how is West Europe going to deal with somebody like him who takes a different view, at least in the campaign, on Ukraine, takes a different view on NATO, and he has advisors who have all kinds of pretty radical views when you compare them to the traditional American position.
And you have a situation where you need multilateralism. Sorry for the wonky word there. You need global solutions to some of these problems. Top of them, and this was really what dominated discussions, because it's really a double summit we're talking about. It's both, it's one eye on Brazil, the other on the UN climate summit that's been taking place in Azerbaijan. Back in Rio, climate activists sounding the alarm for a burning planet. A reminder that while the G20 meets in Brazil, it's an uphill battle to get to COP29 to agree on financing for the world's poorest countries' energy transition.
Progress together, but I urge you to keep going. I'm sure you will, regardless of my urging or not. This group is has within its power to usher in a new era of sustainable development, to go from billions to trillions in assistance of those most in need.
Yeah, that call for trillions by the outgoing U.S. president met with a healthy dose of skepticism by the host of the G20, who, by the way, also hosts next year's UN Climate Summit.
While we're here, our representatives are in Baku negotiating a new goal to have private financing. There's no ambition that can sustain without implementation. In Paris, we talked about $100 billion a year, which the developed world did not meet. Today, we're talking about trillions.
André Lezucco-Preci, good luck then coming up with this financing, which is the future of our common planet.
And unfortunately, on that one, Lula has a point. I mean, saying that, you know, we cannot talk about trillions when we're not able to already meet what was agreed at the Paris Climate Accord, which is this transfer and adaptation funds that are badly needed. And the future does not look rosy, because the finances of all the, I would say, G7 countries are in pretty bad shape. I mean, talk about France and Germany. But I think in the U.S., there is also going to be a big, probably a cut on federal expenditures. And those might be the ones who will be cut first.
For Jamil Chad, is this the issue for Brazilians, climate?
This is not the issue only for the G20. It is also COP29 and COP30 in Brazil next year. But just to put in numbers, what Lula was a bit saying very, very clearly, that, you know, you could see that he was not satisfied. One of the elements was the fact that before landing in Rio, Joe Biden made a stop in Manaus, basically the capital of the Amazon region. And there he announced a donation to the Amazon Fund, which is this mechanism basically to help protecting the Amazon. And he announced $50 million. Just so we can put this in perspective, $50 million is the equivalent of the military aid the U.S. gives to Israel in less than one day. So this $50 million was supposed to be for the entire year for the protection of the Amazon, which, let's remember here, it is bigger than the size of Europe. So when Lula speaks out in that tone, it is not because the Paris Agreement is not being fulfilled, the $100 billion is not there, but also because the promises and the generosity, let's say, in speeches are very clear. They're not met in real life. Now, as you said there, is this the big challenge? For sure, this is the biggest challenge of the 21st century. And let's remember, so far, the names Donald Trump has put forward in, for example, in the Protection Agency, Environmental Protection Agency, but also the Transportation Department and others as well, it shows a very clear pattern of choosing people who are pro-deregulation, the exploitation of oil, and not exactly what climate, let's say, activists would love to hear.
Yeah, but last time around, Jamil, it was said that, oh, yes, but this is such a vital need that the private sector is picking up the slack.
Well, it is not picking up the slack. Obviously, you will need public investment for this. You will need public policies for this as well. So yes, obviously, this partnership between governments and the private sector will have to happen, but governments have to lead the way. So yes, $50 million, depending on approval of the American Congress, which obviously at this point is very hard to predict. So just to make it clear here, the irritation, let's put it like this, that this sentence by Joe Biden generated was basically, well, if you recognize that trillions are needed, how is it that you don't basically act accordingly?
Siddharth Varadarajan, you're on the front lines of this week. What with schools being closed in the Indian capital due to smog? There's smog every year at this time in northern India, but this year it's particularly acute. Listening to what we just heard there from Jamil, there's a sense that it doesn't bode very well for the UN climate summit taking place right now in Azerbaijan, and it certainly doesn't bode well for the one next year.
No, it doesn't. And I think this reinforces the fact that Trump's rhetoric, which is seen as quite astonishing around the world, right? He uses the phrase America first, and you refer to that as well, or one of your guests did. And the reality is that American policy has been America first for years. And you see this reflected in the American attitude towards climate change. So Biden talks the talk, but when it comes to ensuring adequate finance, ensuring adequate sharing of technologies, the U.S. is way behind what it really needs to do. I should add that the smog problem in Delhi isn't so much an issue of climate change as opposed to simply mismanagement on a catastrophic scale at the national level. That's a separate topic. But India has raised the issue in Baku today, in fact. The inadequacy of financing, for example. And this is a perennial, this is a long-standing problem that we've seen several American presidents, you know, make tall claims and then fail to deliver. And I think that that's obviously going to get worse with Trump.
Is it all in the United States is also the question, Siddharth. You know, who pays for this? Remember, this is climate finance so that the poorest countries can either mitigate or do an energy transition. And you know, they're the likes of China, for certain, right now still refusing to be a contributor, a net contributor on this. What about India?
No, I think India, China, all countries have a responsibility here. But the fact is that the line India has taken is of common and differentiated responsibility. So you can't ignore the fact that India and China, based on where they are in their development, I would say China is quite well ahead, but certainly a country like India, which still has a lot to do to bring consumption levels of its people up to a reasonable standard, obviously cannot be held to the same yardstick as the US. But I think India obviously also has a lot to do, perhaps not so much in financing as opposed to ensuring that its own national commitments are followed through. And here I would say, you know, India has done a lot in terms of renewables. There's a big push for solar, for example, under the present government. So, you know, India is doing what it can. It isn't enough by a long shot. And you have Indian climate activists who frequently point this out. But I think when it comes to global responsibilities, particularly on the question of financing and the sharing of technologies, the U.S. really needs to do a lot more.
Is it all up to the U.S., Andrei Lozgorod-Petry?
Well, I think the U.S. is both one of the biggest emitter and obviously one of the biggest producers of these technologies. But I think, yes, I mean, it would have been so much easier if the financing part has been, because it would be easier for the big emitters like the developing countries like China and India to actually meet their targets. Here, it's very easy to put the blame on both sides. So I think, I mean, politics and short term clearly killed any kind of ambition. And what's going to be very interesting is next year will be for the Europeans, you know, the introduction of this carbon barrier mechanism, CBAM. And we will see, actually, if our geopolitical weight is still strong enough to be able to push that upon the rest of the world. Or will it be like, for example, an AI right now, where people consider, well, the regulation in Europe is too stringent. We just don't put the latest innovation in Europe. So I think it's going to be interesting where this nexus between geopolitics and economics.
Is there an opening there for the European Union?
Well, if the European Union had a strategy, if the European Union was a heavyweight in terms of political force, but look, I mean, all European countries today are extremely weak internally. So it's not even a question of having two European presidents, which is this ridiculous image that von der Leyen and Charles Michel give us. Even the Europeans don't understand. So I don't understand who...
President of the European Council, the other of the European Commission.
So that's already showing a lot of fragmentation. But if at least they were supported by strong governments with a mandate from their people, no, we have coalitions that in Germany broke down, and in France is probably only a question of weeks or months that this current government stays.
That's the key, a mandate from the people. Look, in the United States... greenhouse gases and climate change are on the bottom of the preoccupations of American voters. When Joe Biden, the Biden presidency, tried to do something about that and put money into green energy, he didn't present it, first of all, as green energy, but an attempt to create jobs and bring down inflation. So the very direction of the spending was labeled as something other than trying to bring down...
It was called the Inflation Reduction
Act. Yeah,
Inflation
Reduction Act. Extremely smart from a political point of view.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, once again, heads of government are not going to take a risk when they well know that this issue, even in France and other countries, is at the bottom of the preoccupations of their citizens. And economic growth, jobs, and inflation, that's top. And if you have to sacrifice, I'm guessing here, if you have to sacrifice... clean energy to do that, I think it will probably be done for political survival.
All right, so every nation for itself, tariffs in vogue, as Stephen was saying earlier, yet free trade deals aren't dead yet, with the EU on the brink of ratifying an accord with South American Mercosur nations, French farmers back out on the roads and on the streets, blocking the border with Spain this Tuesday for a while, denouncing a race to the bottom on prices and standards. President Macron, he's vowed to oppose that Mercosur deal, but he's outnumbered in Brussels. Selina Sykes has more.
After years of being on standby, a free trade agreement between the EU and Mercosur could finally be ratified in the coming weeks. on one condition, that at least 15 member states representing 65% of the European population vote in its favour. France is the most fiercely opposed to the deal.
Il est impensable.
It's unthinkable that while we impose particularly tough restrictions and requirements on our producers in Europe, whether agricultural or industrial, that we don't ask our trading partners to respect the same requirements.
France is trying to persuade hesitant countries to form a minority bloc to halt the agreement. Another big country against the deal is Italy, which says the treaty is not acceptable in its current form. Poland and Austria have also voiced their opposition, but their support alone is not enough. Greece, Cyprus, Belgium and the Netherlands have also expressed doubts, but their final position is unclear. In contrast, Germany and Spain want to conclude negotiations before the end of the year. They see the advantage of opening up a new market where they can export their products.
Is the European Union interested at this moment in closing in on itself? Or is it interested in expanding the network of our trade agreements with third countries to maintain our economic and commercial influence as well? I think the answer is very clear.
11 countries wrote to President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, to explicitly express their support for the agreement. In order to get around France's categoric opposition, some have suggested a controversial solution, to split the deal, which would separate the trade pillar, including tariffs, import quotas and the sustainability chapter, from the political dialogue and cooperation part. Such a move would mean that the trade pillar could be adopted by a qualified majority at the European Council, without having the backing of a majority of member states.
Yeah, will there be a mandate or not? Let's begin with you on this one. André Lozgo-Petri, you see, multilateralism isn't dead yet, even though it's unpopular, especially among French farmers.
And especially for Europe. I mean, Europe is probably with China the bloc which depends the most on open borders and free trade. I mean, think about Germany, but also France for its agricultural products. We depend massively on our exports. So on the long run, these kind of trade deals are extremely important. I mean, that is what made also Europe strong in the last 30 or 40 years. Here, I have a little bit different view than what you can hear a lot in France right now. I think the opposition, especially of farmers, is a demonstration that we have not been able to create a farming industry that is resilient and can be very competitive globally. When you see the average amount that a farmer does in France is less than a minimum wage, that means we have not been able to really structurally make these industry competitive. So probably it's also a little bit our own faults, which are today guarded behind barriers. But I think that is the kind of homework we need to do. And, you know, coming more from the scientific and technology point of view, I just give you one example. I mean, the GMOs, which were very controversial because it's insertion of foreign genes, now you are calling that new breeding techniques, which actually is new only re-engineering existing genes. It sounds a bit technical, but it's much less dangerous because you're only treating a plant or a crop, a specific crop. The GMO...
It's not Frankenfood.
No, it's not Frankenfood at all. It's something that nature has done for millions of years to just optimize the thing. And this is something that we're still refusing in the EU because the regulation of the EU dates back of 98 where these kind of techniques did not exist. So what I'm calling for is we need to make much more leap forward and explain that to our farmers and raise their level. Otherwise, of course, when people are not making a lot of money, they will be very quickly, and rightly so, go to the streets.
So, Jamil Chad, despite Donald Trump, free trade deals can be made.
Well, that is the big question we're going to see next year, whether Europe will step in and think, well, from one side, all South American countries have China as their biggest trading partner. You have the U.S. coming as well, very strongly on tariffs. What we do with South America. Now, let me just put two elements into this story, just so we can debate it regarding numbers and real impacts. I've been covering this trade deal since 1999, when Jacques Chirac met Fernando Henrique Cardoso, the president of Brazil, that time to launch the debate. Since then, over these years, what we have seen is a shrinking size, let's say, of this trade deal. Today, the trade deal that is being offered to be ratified or to be agreed is much smaller than anything we had on the table in 2006, 2007, 2008. So it actually shows that obviously this was reduced in scope. There will not be a free trade on agriculture between Mercosur and Europe. Products exported by the South American countries will have to meet a certain quota, meaning after this amount of trade being exported, it will not continue with the same tariffs, meaning there won't be any kind of an invasion of products from South America to the European market. Having said that, it is clear that there is also an element of, let's say, a political element, Mercosur being used as sort of a scapegoat. And why I'm saying this? Because very recently, actually at the end of last year, when the trade deal was about to be signed, Macron told President Lula that these partners, should be aware of the impact the agreement would have in giving support by farmers to the far right in France. So meaning it had no real impact in terms of trade, or not as much as is being said, but it would give a political leverage to the far right to come to the farmers and say, hey, look what your government is doing to you. So this was the talk between Macron and Lula at the end of last year, basically to explain why France was also blocking the agreement. Why I'm telling all of this, because obviously this is a trade deal, but it has a profound political impact.
A profound political impact. And you wonder, again, it's that chicken and egg question that Andre laid out earlier between when you think of a G20 summit between politics and business. Case in point, Siddharth Varadarajan. We saw at the recent BRICS summit that shaking of hands between Narendra Modi and Xi Jinping. Is that just because, well, in the end, China is India's number one trading partner, and while they may be rivals, while they may have border disputes, it's in neither side's interest to close the border completely?
Well, the handshake and the agreement at the Kazan summit was essentially to de-escalate a pretty nasty situation that has been prevailing on a section of the border in Ladakh for the last pretty much 3 years. And because of that standoff, the government of India had virtually suspended cooperation with China across a whole range of issues. Trade continued, of course, as has Chinese investment in India and some amount of Indian investment in China. But serious obstacles were emerging in terms of the issuing of visas for Chinese technicians to come and work in India, and so on and so forth. And what we saw in the 6 months preceding this handshake was a lot of pressure from Indian companies, the Adani Group, for example, and others, that wanted some softening of the government of India's stance that there will be no business as usual with China until China restores the status quo ante on the border. So I think the Indian government, which was divided on this issue, appears to have chosen a path of pragmatism. And the Chinese were always willing to have normal relations on the trade side. And the Chinese are quite, you know, happy to separate provoking India on the boundary while making money through trade and investment. But the Indians had slowed down the economic relationship, I think, to the detriment of the Indian economy. And so you are right. I mean, I think pragmatism did prevail. But I would be cautious in overanalyzing the extent to which the two leaders have reached an understanding. I think that the situation could easily get destabilized. And I think if Trump escalates U.S. conflict with China and then makes a demand on the Indian side. For example, India and the U.S. are part of the Quad, and India has resisted turning the Quad into a military alliance or a grouping of sorts. If Trump demands that the Quad become take on security responsibilities or military responsibilities, that's something India will have to think very, very hard about. And I don't think I see much of an appetite, even on the part of somebody like Narendra Modi, to take India down that road. Mm. So these are all issues that India will have to sort out over the next year, first couple of years of the Trump presidency.
Yeah, do you follow the money or do you follow the politics? Here's a quandary. Elon Musk, he does business in China, and here he is by Donald Trump's side seemingly every day. Andrei Lizakoug-Petri, at the end of the day, will all this China bashing subside?
Well, I'm not so sure that Trump will be necessarily worse for China than the current Biden administration. I mean, Biden pursued already the pivot and the I would say the great power competition that was initiated by Obama. And actually, Biden was Obama with a strategy. He implemented much tougher rules. Think about chips, totally excluding Huawei, putting pressure on Europeans. Think about the pressure on a company like ASML, producing tools for producing these semiconductors. So I think Trump is going to be more transactional. And indeed, Elon Musk will be there with this very peculiar situation where one of his biggest plans for Tesla is in the vicinity of Shanghai. And he has not severed the ties at all with the country. And on the other side, being part of a very America first administration. So I think it's, again, there is not going to be a country strategy. There is going to be a case-by-case strategy, which makes all these groupings so complicated. I mean, G7, yes, it was the rich club, but it was a club which was made of like-minded countries. I mean, Biden administration like to say, you know, friends and allies. There's no more friends and allies because they're so different. You will have AUKUS, you will have the Quad, you will have the BRICS, but even the BRICS, it's anti-West. But when you see the tensions that Siddharth very clearly showed between China and India, you don't see a joint strategy, just an opposition.
Stephen Ekovich, a final word on this?
The world is covered by a very complex network of international institutions, non-governmental organizations. If you look at a textbook of political economy, you can find a very elegant proof that specializing in trading, that means bringing down trade barriers, benefits everybody. In the abstract, that's true. But then you bring in culture, national security, and politics, and the whole picture gets distorted. So in the abstract, everybody can be for it. It's a great liberal economic principle. But when you bring in politics, once again, in its multifaceted forms, it once again complicates things.
And climate might be the collateral victim of all that.
Yeah, and climate will probably certainly be that, yeah.
All right. On that happy note, thank you, Andrei Lizakoug-Petri. We'll end it there. Yeah. Stephen Ekovich, I want to thank you. I want to thank Jamil Shad for being with us from Geneva, Siddhartha Varadarajan in Delhi. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.